Let's pray. We thank you, divine loving presence, for bringing us together in this beautiful place with these beautiful souls, a place filled with such love and such heart and such openness and caring. We look forward to this week where we can take our journey farther out and be with you and experience your presence. Thank you, God. Amen. So I'm trying something new by using my iPad, and hopefully it's not a big mistake. So I want to thank the Council Ring for inviting me here to speak. This is my first time at Winnie, although I have heard about this wonderful camp for years and years and years. I think I probably first heard about it from my dear friend Gloria Knapstad, who was a presence here, I know, and was a speaker and I think a song leader and in many other capacities, and many of my other friends who have come here and said, you will love Winnie. They're a wonderful group of people, and they love to sing, and they have wonderful, wonderful energy. And I have found that to be true. I'm so grateful for your welcoming of me and your warmth and care, and just thank you so much for making me feel so at home. But I have to say I'm a little nervous to share my spiritual walk with you. As I'm sure all of you longtime CFOers know, the speaker is a camper first. And I'm just a camper that's been asked to share my spiritual journey, which is what I plan to do this week. And I want to say that one of my personal truths is that we decide for ourselves what is true for us, each of us individually, and we come at what we believe to be true through many different pathways. Glenn Clark in The Bond of Faith, paragraph 5, says, everything about our union together and our basis for working together shall be as fluid as the sea and as free as the air. Christ and all he represents is central. Everything else is marginal. Where and when we find confusion in our concept of him, we feel assured that when we vision that concept through the lens of the Sermon on the Mount and the two great commandments and his sacrifice on the cross, we shall see him as he really is. In our attempts to get close to Christ, some may take the door of mysticism, some the door of sacraments, some the gateway of metaphysics, and some the path of social service. The indispensable thing is that no matter what the door we may take or use, we shall all arrive at the place where we shall all have the mind of Christ Jesus. And I love that because it gives us permission to come to our union with Jesus Christ through whatever door speaks to us. And as I have gotten to this stage in my life, I think probably the door that has spoken to me most is the door of mysticism. And others of you may also have taken that door, and maybe several doors. Some of you may have taken the door of sacrament or social service, and they all bring us to that same place of our union with Jesus. So I ask us this week to keep those words in our heart and understand that we don't all take the same door to get close to Christ, but no matter, we arrive at that same place. And so it's not my intention to offend anyone or anyone's beliefs. Please know this is my spiritual journey, and it may not be yours, and that's okay. And you may disagree with some of what I say, and that's okay. Just take what works for you, what rings for you, and leave the rest behind. That's okay. I've met so many wonderful, deeply spiritual people in the many years I've been attending CFO and JFO, and I'm sure this year will continue that experience. And I would like to extend a real welcome to Winnie, to the JFO family, and express to you how excited the other three camps are to have Winnie be a part of JFO now. And I understand that perhaps for some of you this may be hard, that you may feel a loss of your official affiliation with CFO. And I just want to acknowledge that and tell you I understand that. And I hope those feelings, if you have them, will not prevent you from having a deeply spiritual experience this week, rooted in the love that I know you share for one another and for all these camps that were envisioned to be so many years ago, right on these very grounds. So this week I plan to share with you my own spiritual journey, which has been marvelous in so many ways. And I would like to start my talks this week by introducing myself to you. And then through the rest of the week, I'll move into some different ponderings that I have and topics. And again, please listen for what may ring true for you. And if something I say doesn't, then leave it behind. And as Susan said last night, you may find a nugget here, and that is what your heart wants to hear. So I'll start by saying I was born of immigrants. So I am first-generation American. And with all that's going on today concerning immigration, I feel it is important to acknowledge that. I don't plan to talk about politics. I just want to acknowledge that I myself am the child of immigrants. My parents were both born and raised in the Prairie Provinces of Canada. Children of pioneers who forged their way west across Canada and descended from immigrants from Ireland and Scotland. Both spent much of their childhoods in farming communities, and both were in families that had enough but not wealthy by any means. And I think those facts shaped their values, which in turn shaped mine. My father arrived in San Francisco in 1928, where he joined his mother and began high school. His father had died during the great flu epidemic of 1918 when my father was 4 and living in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. His mother left him with one of her siblings in Manitoba and moved down to San Francisco to live with her sister and became a bookkeeper in the Writing Academy in Golden Gate Park. Dad joined her in high school, went through high school, had hopes of going on to UC Berkeley for college. But it was during the Great Depression, and one of my grandmother's friends told him he needed to forget about college and go out and get some training and get a job because his mother might lose hers if a man needed her position. They would lay her off, give her job to a man, and so he needed to be in a position to earn some money. So his hopes of going to college were dashed, but he went on and he went to business college and became a secretary. At that time, most of the secretaries were men. But as a result of that and his not getting to fulfill his dream of going to college, he was determined that my two older sisters and I would go to college, and I'm very grateful for that. He went on to work in the field of transportation planning, which he loved and had an aptitude for. He went to work in Death Valley in the Trona Bauxite and Chemical Corporation, planning train schedules and the movement of bauxite at that time. I don't know if any of you are old enough to have remembered Death Valley days on television, but that was where they lived. And my middle sister was born there. During World War II, he joined the Army and became an officer stationed at the Pentagon. He and my mom got married then, and my oldest sister was born in Washington, D.C. during the war. Dad's job was planning supply lines and provisions for the troops overseas, particularly in the Pacific. It was a challenging job to try and anticipate where General MacArthur and his troops would be several months or weeks in advance and make sure that the supplies were there when they got there, the food and ammunition and all the things that allow troops to do their jobs. Following the war, Dad went to work for the Department of Defense in Oakland, planning military and government movement in the event of a nuclear war. At that time in the 50s, it was the Cold War. Nuclear threat was pretty in the public's mind. I can remember touring air raid shelters and having air raid drills hiding under our desks, which were not much of a protection. But that was that era. And his job was to plan where all the trucks and things were in California that could move the government in the event that the government had to declare martial law and take over all the trucking to move the government into a secret place. He loved planning transportation. One of his other jobs was planning rocket movements from the factories to Vandenberg Air Force Base. He had to figure out where all the low-hanging overpasses were so that they could route it around that and get the rockets to where they were going to be needed. He loved to travel, and he loved to drive. So our family vacations were usually road trips, all planned out to a gnat's eyebrow because he was a transportation planner. So there was no room for spontaneity, but we knew where we were going to stay each night, and we would take these roads. One time he decided that the shortcut would be a 500-mile forestry road that was a dirt road, and by the time we got to our destination in Glacier Park, everything had an inch of dust on it in the car. But we got to see a lot of the western states growing up, and I'm grateful for that. We went to Canada a few times to see relatives. And one summer, Dad also wanted our trip to be educational, and so we drove up to Oregon and did the Lewis and Clark Trail backwards, stopping at every Lewis and Clark monument all the way up to Montana. And when he finally reached the age of 59, he retired, and then he and my mother continued to travel. Now, my mother grew up in a very tiny community in the middle of the wheat fields of West Manitoba, where her father was a supervisor of the local grain elevator. They had a one-room schoolhouse, and often the school teacher lived with them. She told me once, life was hard, but people looked out for one another. And they were all poor, but they didn't really know they were poor because they were all in the same situation. She dreamed of being a dress designer and a seamstress, and was on the verge of realizing that dream as a young woman when she moved to Edmonton and worked in the alterations department of a department store. But then World War II broke out, and all the men in Canada, basically, that were of fighting age, joined the British Army or military, and she was called back to Edmonton to help out in to help out around the home and the house and the farm. So when my dad wrote and proposed marriage to her, she packed up a steamer truck, got on the train, and headed to Washington, D.C. While I was growing up, my mother was considered one of the best seamstresses and cooks among all my friends' mothers. She made all our clothes, and all our meals were made from scratch. She learned and taught cake decorating, so her cakes were always the first to go at the PTA carnival cakewalks. I share all this because our parents taught us basic certain rules of conduct and behavior that were rooted in that generation in Canadian farmland values, tempered by the Depression, and dreams not realized. I was born the youngest of my three sisters, and San Francisco was my hometown. During my growing up years, the only place I lived for the first 23 years of my life were within 50 miles of San Francisco. That may seem the norm out here in New England, where people may go back generations, but in California, it's seldom the situation where people are born and raised and grow up all through their childhood in one place. In 1955, when I was four, we moved to a sleepy but growing bedroom community of Novato, just 30 miles north of San Francisco in Marin County. It was post-World War II baby boom generation, and new housing developments were springing up all over the place in what had been a pear orchard. There was no Methodist church when we moved in, but sometime shortly after we arrived, my parents connected with some other folks who were Methodist and started meeting in people's garages on Sunday mornings. I remember as a child playing in the driveway while the parents sat in a circle on folding chairs, starting the little Methodist church. Soon a two-acre parcel with a little house on it was purchased, and that became our church. When I was five, we had a cement foundation poured that was to become our new sanctuary. And one Sunday morning, under the tree, sitting on folding chairs on that cement slab, I was baptized on the same day the church received its charter from the Methodist Church. You might say my early church experience was built on a very solid foundation. That was true, literally and figuratively. So we were very active in that little Methodist church, and since my father was a Sunday school superintendent, we never missed a Sunday unless we were on vacation. What I learned in that church over my growing up years truly did create the foundation of my spiritual journey. I loved the stories about Jesus. I used to imagine I was one of those children sitting at his feet, thrilled when he told his disciples to let the children come to him. Even at that age, I think I had an internal compass that led me to believe certain things were core and essential teachings. These were primarily Jesus' teachings to love one another as he loved us, and to love God, and to love our neighbors as we loved ourselves. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. These teachings seemed pretty clear to me as a child, and they still ring true for me today. Simple, clear, unambiguous. As I grew up, church played a central role in my life. I still have friends I made there as a child. Some of you may know Wendy Silverthorne. She and I met in Sunday school when we were in first grade, and we're still very close friends. Now, I've always had a curious mind, and one of the areas, the big areas of my curiosity from the Bible stories I read, were the miracles that Jesus did. There were the spontaneous healings, the revival of Lazarus from death, the feeding of the multitudes with a mere 5 loaves and a few fishes, walking on water, the knowing what was going to happen before it happened. These were fascinating to me, and I started to wonder what happened to that. My church certainly was not doing any of those things, nor was anyone I knew. There seemed to be an attitude of, well, those are just Bible stories. Maybe Jesus did those things. We like to say he did, but then we're not really Jesus, and we don't really believe that stuff can really happen. That was the attitude that I picked up from the adults. But in my mind, if those weren't true, how could I trust anything else in the Bible was true? And if they were true, then, during the time of Jesus, why not now? What happened to those abilities? These were the kind of things I chewed on as a child. And when Jesus said, "These things I do and greater things than these can you do also," I thought, well, that must be true too. Another thing that puzzled me as a child was that only Christians go to heaven. That made no sense to me, and still doesn't. Why, I asked myself, would God create billions of people and then condemn them in the afterlife if they didn't embrace Jesus? What if they never heard of Jesus? What if, like me, their parents instilled in them a devotion to a certain faith and they lived good lives, but that religion didn't happen to be Christian? That was a question I've held for many years, and I'll come back to that later. So in my high school years, I began to look outside my church for examples of these acts of miracles and faith that Jesus taught about. And I wondered about the science behind it. You know, what if these things happened, what was the science behind that? This led me to explore books about psychic experiences, and I started reading countless books with fascinating stories that science could not really explain at that time, at least not that I knew of. So there were books by Edgar Cayce, who seemed to have lots to say about a lot of people and the advice he gave remotely based on his ability or power to discern information not usually accessed. Stories about previous lifetimes and children who could remember details of another life that there was no way they should know. Small village names and faraway places they had never been to. With street addresses of their former residents and names of their relatives and neighbors from some other time period, and even facts about their own deaths. Some children could suddenly start speaking in another language that was not the language of their upbringing or their family. The more I read, the more curious I became. I read a book about psychic discoveries behind the Iron Curtain and the experiments the Russians were doing into psychic phenomenon. I read a book by a woman who started doing what was called automatic writing, where she sat with a pencil above a pad of paper and wrote things, the source of which she could not explain. I read books about people who could do remote healing. It is fascinating to me that in the earlier days of CFO, and maybe now in some of the camps also, healings were occurring, energetic healings. I've heard stories about Glenn Clark gathering a group of folks around the bedside of someone who was sick at camp and performing healings. Given Jesus' example and teachings, that should not seem at all strange to us, but rather the norm. Agnes Sanford was an early CFO participant and was quite a healer. The Healing Light is a fascinating book that she wrote about healing. All of this reading I was doing seemed to confirm the kind of miracles I read about in the Bible, but not much of it came from or was sanctioned by the church that I attended. And that created in me a sense of compartmentalization. There was the church and all that we were doing in the church, and then there was all this other realm that wasn't really talked about in the church. However, there was one person who had a really important impact on my quest for confirmation of God's presence, and that was my junior high school church youth group leader. One afternoon, our group was talking, and she shared with us an experience she had had that cemented her faith and belief in Jesus' power of love and healing. She was a young mother with three small children and a husband who worked in law enforcement. One night, she was home taking care of the kids while her husband was at work. She had a pot of boiling water on the stove and got distracted by the children yelling and crying and carrying on, and she burned her hand very badly on the boiling water. She was in excruciating pain, but she had to carry on feeding her children and getting them ready and going to bed. And once her children were in bed, she went into the kitchen and just cried. She broke down from the stress and the strain and the pain of her burned hand, and then she prayed. And I think her prayer was something simple like, "Help me." She sat crying and praying, and as she did, she became aware that the light in the room got much, much brighter, and a voice said to her, "Do not look at me. Keep your eyes closed." She could see through her closed eyelids that there was a very, very bright light in the room, and she felt a very, very loving presence. The voice told her to stretch out her hand, which she did, and she could feel a huge energy coursing through her hand. After a time, the light faded, the energy subdued, and her hand was completely healed. She told us that she had no doubt that presence was Jesus, and he had healed both her hand and her despair. I loved hearing this story, and I too wanted a personal experience of the divine. I believe without any doubt that when we turn to God in prayer or meditation, God or God's helpers are there for us. In my last year of high school, I was feeling pretty overwhelmed with all I had to do and deadlines that all seemed to be happening at the same time. I was stressed and didn't know what to do or how I could possibly get everything done. As I was saying my prayers before bedtime, I asked for help, and then I just sat. All of a sudden, in my mind's eye, I was somewhere else. I was sitting on some green grass on the side of a mountain with snow-covered peaks all around me. There was a little path through the grass that transversed the mountain, and it was a beautiful sunny day. Blue sky, puffy white clouds, perfect temperature. There were wildflowers and a couple of butterflies, and it looked like a scene out of the movie Heidi with Shirley Temple. That dates me. But it was in full living color and very real feeling. As I sat on the grass, I felt the most profound sense of peace I had ever experienced, and I sensed a voice saying to me, "Don't worry, all will be well." The scene gradually faded, but that profound sense of peace stayed with me, and I no longer worried about the deadlines, and as I recall, I met them without further stress. I knew God had heard my prayer and was with me, and it gave me great comfort. Eventually, by the time I reached college, I wanted to experience firsthand someone who seemed to be able to tap into that alternative reality. I heard about a woman in Novato named Betty Bethards who conducted a session once a month at which she taught a form of meditation and then did little psychic readings for some members of the audience. I attended her session one evening, and she just threw a form of meditation that started with 10 minutes of focus, where we envisioned some image that spoke to us and tried to keep our minds totally focused on whatever that image was to clear all other thoughts out of our minds. And that 10 minutes was followed by another 10 minutes of trying to keep an empty mind and not focus or think about anything. The idea was that when we focused on one thing to the exclusion of everything else and then opened to focus on nothing, our minds would be cleansed of those monkey mind thoughts that clutter our awareness and our consciousness, and so be able to tap into that greater consciousness. I decided to sign up for one of her meditation groups to learn how to meditate this way. This was my introduction into meditation, and I wasn't very good at it to start with. I had trouble staying focused for 10 minutes on just one thing. I chose to focus on a red rosebud as something that was beautiful and hopefully mind-clearing. During the open mind portion, though, I was scared that something would actually happen, like I would see a dead person or something. So I was pretty tense at that stage. Our leader, after one of the sessions, gave us feedback on what she experienced about each of us. When she described me, she said, "I see a tightly closed flower wanting to open, but afraid of what it will find." That described my experience to a T. Despite my fears of visitation from otherworldly beings, I continued to practice this form of meditation. That meditation practices on and off to this day, continues on and off to this day, and has been the source of a great deal of my spiritual guidance. It worked on me subtly without me really being aware of the guidance I was receiving. For example, during college one time, I was living away from home, which was only about 20 miles away, and my parents were gone on a trip. I went and stayed at their house by myself. One evening, I was sitting alone, eating dinner, and I decided I wanted the time to be productive. So I said to myself, "I'm going to do some deep thinking while I eat, instead of just empty kind of random thoughts." So I posed the question out loud, "What is the purpose of life?" Almost immediately, the thought came into my mind was, "The purpose of life is to seek to find one's potential and then live into that potential." I was surprised as that thought had never occurred to me. So I got a piece of paper and pen and wrote that down. And then I asked, "What is the opposite of love?" And to which came the reply, "Many people think the opposite of love is hate, but that is not true. The opposite of love is fear." So I wrote that down too. By the time I finished eating, I had a whole piece of paper with my questions and what I considered pretty profound responses. They certainly weren't thoughts from my conscious intellect, and I had the sense of having had a conversation with a very wise being. I believe to this day that I was not having this conversation by myself, as these were thoughts more profound than my thinking to that point had led me. Both of those thoughts seemed to have that quality of what I call bell ringers. You know those little ring bells that sit on a hotel desk or a counter, and you come along and you want to get somebody's attention, and you tap it and it rings. It's like that bell goes off in my mind when there's something profound that I should pay attention to, and I call them bell ringer thoughts. Now, there are times when I have a question about something, whether it be a decision I'm trying to make or just a general question about life or who knows what, and I ask that kind of question. Oftentimes, something will emerge from the background noise of everyday life. The bell goes off, and I get an answer. So, for example, one day I was standing in line at the grocery store, not really paying attention to anything around me or the conversation that was happening between the person in front of me and the clerk. And I was mulling on some question, I don't remember what, but suddenly, whatever the conversation was that the checker and the person had were having, I could hear a little snippet of it, and it was the answer to the question I had been mulling. Totally out of a different context than what they were talking about, but it was like Spirit spoke to me through them in this little bell ringer thought. Sometimes it's mundane things, sometimes more significant, and sometimes it's just a headline on a magazine or a newspaper that, taken out of context, seems to hold a gem or a nugget for me. And I think we're all capable of getting such guidance if we open and are alert to those bell ringers and don't just brush them off as coincidence. As I look back at my pathway and my keen desire to explore the realm of psychic phenomena, I think it was at heart a desire for an authentic spiritual encounter with the divine, or God. I wanted a firsthand experience. Now, I have never seen angels or ghosts, but I have no doubt I have encountered and been guided by spirit. And I use this term spirit to mean higher guidance. Maybe God, maybe spiritual helpers, maybe my deeper subconscious, maybe the collective unconscious. I don't really know what it is. I just call it my guidance. And I mentioned the challenge I had with the concept that the only way to experience God's love is through belief in Jesus. I know for me this is my path. But what about those who have a different path? My college program was a new cluster school concept where we had small seminars, read about 30 books a semester, obtained our general education units through theme-based approaches each semester, had a professor and 10 students, and sat around discussing. And that was all our GE requirement, most of our upper level courses, and it was all pass-fail. We had to do a project on any topic of our choosing every semester, and again, pass-fail. One semester, I decided to learn about the different world religions, as I wanted to know what different religions believed and see if there is any commonality. As I was meditating one day with a question in my mind about the different religions and this conundrum of a loving God and the exclusivity of Christianity, an image came to my mind of a wagon wheel. I'm sure you've seen pictures or the real thing of a wooden circle with a number of wooden spokes going to the center or the hub through which the axle goes. So I had a very vivid image of a wagon wheel, and a voice in my mind said, "The wheel is like religions. Each spoke represents a different religion. They are all connected through the outer rim and all lead to the same place. They all lead to God in the center of all." So every religion based in love with God at the center will return those people to God. There are many paths, but only one God, and we are all united in the love of God. This was a comforting answer to me. For me, this does not lessen the value I found and have found in my Christian faith. I believe Jesus was a manifestation of God, and I believe he came to this earth to teach us that we are as well. As he taught us to love one another, even those so-called others, this extends, in my belief, to other religious traditions as well. And I believe Glenn Clark felt the same way, as he alludes to in many of his writings. So throughout my college years, I continued on my spiritual quest, but found that organized religion was not feeding my soul's desire. So I stopped attending church. I was also questioning myself with doubts about some of the Bible. I thought, who am I to say what I believe and don't believe? Who am I to say what's true for me and not true? Must I accept all of it or none of it? Can I pick and choose? And how do I discern what is truth? I gave these thoughts a lot of pondering during those years, and at one time decided since I could not believe all of it, and it would be presumptuous to pick and choose, then I should believe none of it. Sometime during this period, and it might have been after college, I read a book called Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. This book changed the trajectory of my beliefs and brought me a completely different understanding of Jesus as the embodiment of Christ consciousness. And it also introduced me to Eastern religious thought, where I found much religion, but it brought me back to my Christian faith. During these post-college years, I went on to obtain an elementary teaching credential, even though there were very few teaching positions. I had moved to Long Beach in Southern California by this time and attended Cal State University at Long Beach at night, working during the day as a teacher's aide in special education. I loved my work with the Severe Language Disorder Program children. I took great joy in working one-on-one with kids who were between the ages of 4 and about 7 or 8. I worked under some incredible teachers and learned so much about language development. Being in Los Angeles was a different experience for me as well. If you're not from California, even though we're all one state, there's a decided different culture between Northern California and Southern California. And in Northern California, we thought of Southern California as water grabbers. They wanted our water. So water is a big issue in California. So I was living in LA, in the LA area, and I wanted to experience what Southern California was like. And there were differences. One of the simple differences was that when you asked for directions, they gave you the names of all these different freeways, and often they were different names for the same freeway, and it got very confusing. And when you asked them how long it took to get or how far something was, they didn't respond in miles, they responded in time. So if you say, how far away do you live? They say, oh, about an hour. How many miles will it take? Oh, it'll take you about 45 minutes depending on traffic. And so that was a different point of reference. After I got my teaching credential, I was trying to find a teaching job. The schools where I did my student teaching didn't have any openings, so unlike some of my classmates who were hired into vacancies, I finished with no prospects. And around this time, I had been contemplating becoming a lawyer. I wasn't sure I was smart enough to go to law school and be a lawyer. I thought that lawyers had to be really brilliant, and I've lost my place here, so that proves that point. I was working part-time as a hostess in a Mexican restaurant, and I started meeting some lawyers, and I thought, well, you know, if they could make it through law school, I think I probably could too. So I made a pact with God that summer after I got my credential. I said, okay, God, if I'm supposed to be a teacher, if this is my path, then I'll do what I can to find a job, but you've got to bring a job to me. And so all summer, I sent out resumes, I followed up on the resumes, I sent out 50 applications, I got 2 responses, both saying, sorry, we're not hiring. I followed up with a district that was hiring, they had 12 openings, and they said, we've had 2,000 applicants, there's no chance you're going to get a job. So by the end of summer, I thought, okay, I think my path is to become a lawyer. My only reference to law really was Perry Mason and L.A. Law at that point, so I didn't really know what a lawyer did, but I thought maybe there would be a place for me to combine my education interest in education with the practice of law. So I started preparing and applying for law school, and somehow that path opened up pretty simply. I did real well on the law school admissions test. I got accepted to most of the law schools I applied for, and off I went. Now, my mother, I should point out, she had this approach to life that if you expect the worst, you'll never be disappointed. And so when I told her I was going to apply to law school, she said, well, don't be too disappointed if you don't get in. And when I did, she said, well, don't be too disappointed if you don't make it all the way through. But I did, and I became an attorney. And I found a job with a school law firm, and that's been my career path for the last 38 years of being a school lawyer. And so I'm going to stop here because I have more to say on this one, but I have come to the end of my time, and I don't want to run into Tanya's time. So, to be continued. Thank you.